Disc 27.
Baker, who had recently returned from a stint with the Baltimore Sun's London Bureau, was seated next to Johnson at dinner. As food arrived, he stubbed out a cigarette, lit another, finished his scotch, called for another, and asked how the House of Commons compared with the Senate. When Baker replied that he had been surprised at the lack of debates in the Senate, Johnson, who had taken only two or three mouthfuls of food, shoved his plate aside, stubbed out his cigarette in the food, lit another smoke, drained his whiskey, and called for another. He gave Baker a lecture. Speech-making didn't count for anything when it came to passing bills, he said. What mattered was who had the votes. You want to hear a speech? I can get somebody to make any kind of speech you want to hear. What kind of speech do you want? You want to hear a great speech about suffering humanity? I've got Hubert Humphrey back in the cloakroom. I've got Herbert Lehman. I've got Paul Douglas. You want to hear about government waste? I can give you Harry Byrd. And all the time Lyndon Johnson was talking, Baker was to say, he never stopped smoking and drinking, ignoring the rest of his dinner, waving away dessert, stubbing out cigarette after cigarette in his food, motioning for another drink again and again. I had seen people smoke and drink dinner before, Baker was to say, but Lyndon Johnson did it like a man trying to kill himself. When he ate at home, Johnson's dinners were usually the heavy southern staples he preferred, and he insisted that the portions be big. Huge heaps of black-eyed peas and tapioca pudding, and he shoveled the food into his mouth, head bent low over his plate, so greedily that even the adoring Bobby Baker said he ate like a starving dog. While he may have been skinny at White's dinner party, during the 1955 session his weight rose with almost incredible rapidity. From the 185 pounds it had been when he returned from his annual checkup at the Mayo Clinic in February, to 195, to 200, to 210, 220, 225. Every previous crisis in Lyndon Johnson's career had been accompanied by a crisis in his health. And in every crisis he had refused to allow the illness to interfere, had refused so successfully that colleagues and friends and assistants had scarcely believed in the illnesses, had felt he must be exaggerating them, since if they were genuine, how could he possibly keep working so hard, keep driving himself so mercilessly? How could a man have such energy if there was something seriously wrong with him? For weeks during his first desperate campaign as an unknown candidate for Congress in 1937, he had complained of severe stomach cramps, often doubling over in pain. He couldn't eat. Every time he tried, he gagged or vomited. But he refused to cancel a single speech, drove every day for hours over bumpy hill country roads, had kept campaigning at the pace that made tough Ed Clark say, "I never thought it was possible for anyone to work that hard." And his aides had stopped taking the complaints seriously. And then, during a speech 2 days before the election, he could no longer, even by holding on to a railing in front of him, stay on his feet, and he consented at last to be taken to a hospital, where doctors, rushing him to an operating table, found his appendix on the point of rupturing. During his second desperate campaign, the last chance, all-or-nothing gamble he had taken against the seemingly invincible Coke Stevenson in 1948, the depth of Lyndon Johnson's need to succeed, and of his determination to do so, had once again been illuminated by the way he dealt with illness. He began that campaign suffering from an infected kidney stone. Not only did it produce a 104-degree fever and make it impossible for him to eat, forcing him to vomit over and over until finally he could only retch because there was nothing left in his stomach, but it also caused pain, gripping, radiating cramps in the back, groin, and testicles, that physicians describe as agonizing and unbearable, classifying it as one of the most intense pains a human being can suffer. One of his doctors would say that he didn't know how in the world a man could keep functioning in the pain that he was in. But Lyndon Johnson, bearing the unbearable, not only kept functioning, he kept campaigning, day after day, driving hundreds of miles between Texas towns and cities, walking the streets for hours, shaking hands, making speech after speech. And although, while lying on the back seat of his car, racked with fever and chills, he would gasp in agony, and in bathrooms he would double over, clutching his groin and panting for breath, he never cut a line out of a speech or left a hall afterwards without shaking, with a smile, the hand of every person who wanted to shake his hand. And when, finally forced into a hospital, he was told by doctors that the danger of permanent damage to his kidneys was very real, that an immediate operation was imperative, that postponing the operation in the hope that the stone might pass naturally could prove fatal, Lyndon Johnson nonetheless insisted on postponing it because the operation and the 6-week recovery period would have brought his campaign and perhaps his career to an end, costing him his last chance. He waited for 3 days, each day the doctors warning him that he must wait no longer, and finally insisted, against their advice and against prevailing medical practice because of the great risks involved, that they attempt a still experimental procedure to avoid the operation, insisted with an implacability that raises inescapably questions whose answers lie buried within Lyndon Johnson's labyrinthine personality, whether, if he didn't attain his goal, he didn't care what happened to him, which choice he would make if the choice lay between death and failure. And now, in 1955, as the stakes grew higher, there were again warnings of illness, this time of illness even more serious than an infected kidney stone. And again, Lyndon Johnson refused to let them interfere. Looking back later, colleagues could see how clear the warnings had been. But at the time, the warnings were ignored, ignored not only by other men, but by Lyndon Johnson himself, although fear of a heart attack had been one of the great constants in Lyndon Johnson's life. In May, while managing a foreign affairs bill on the Senate floor, he suddenly clutched his chest for a moment. But when he was asked if anything was wrong, he said impatiently that he merely had a touch of indigestion. Then, on Saturday, June 18th, he and George Smathers were scheduled to drive down to Brown and Root's Virginia estate, Huntlands. They had lunch in the Senate dining room, where, Smathers was to recall, he ate his usual double meal and gulped the food, and got into the big limousine which Norman Edwards was driving. They had just crossed the Memorial Bridge into Virginia when Johnson clutched his chest and gasped out, "It's killing me. I've got indigestion." He had Edwards pull over at a gas station and bring him a Coca-Cola, Smathers says. But even after he drank it, he didn't feel better. And, Smathers says, he was still complaining about the pain during a dominoes game at the Brown estate. Finally, he went to bed, and the next morning he said he was better, Smathers recalls, but he didn't look better. When Smathers asked him to see a doctor, however, he kept saying, "No, no," as though I was looking for trouble. He did, in fact, submit to a cursory examination by the Capitol physician, Dr. George Calver, on Monday, but nothing wrong was found, and Johnson's pace only intensified, although several times each day he would say he felt very tired, statements discounted by whoever heard them because the pace of his activities never slackened. Sometime in late June, telling 2 or 3 reporters about his fatigue, he said that he had had a bad pain and a flutter in his chest the last time he had had sexual intercourse with Lady Bird. "All I could think was, who the hell would say something like that?" one of the reporters recalls. Nobody took it, the symptoms, seriously. On Friday, July 1st, the eve of the 4th of July weekend, George Reedy told John Steele that he felt Johnson was near the edge of sheer exhaustion. And that evening, when Johnson went out to dinner with Sam Rayburn and Stuart Symington, Rayburn was trying to effect a rapprochement between the two men, Rayburn became worried. "He," Johnson, "seemed very tense, seemed to want to talk politics all during dinner," Symington was to say. "He was uptight." Rayburn took the two senators home in his limousine, and after they dropped Johnson off, said to Symington, "He just can't think, eat, or drink anything except the problems he has as majority leader. He won't relax." The next day, Saturday, July 2nd, Johnson was again to go to Huntlands for the weekend, and it had been arranged that Posh Oltorf would drive him down with George and Alice Brown on Saturday morning, but there turned out to be too many things to be done before he could leave, and he said Norman would drive him down later in the day. A score of urgent senatorial matters that he had not been able to attend to during the week had to be resolved. One, involving Senator Francis Case, resulted in 4 separate visits from Case to G-14 that morning, and during the course of the morning Johnson made 7 other telephone calls on Senate business. And there was also a trip to his tailor, Sam Sconia, that in its own way was urgent too, since thanks to the 35 or 40 pounds he had put on in the last 5 months, his suits no longer fit, and he was being measured for 2 new ones, 1 dark blue, 1 brown, both double-breasted and cut very full. He had told Reedy to have reporters from the 3 wire services in G-14 at 3 o'clock for a briefing, out of which Johnson was hoping for articles summing up the Senate's accomplishments thus far in the session, and making it clear that there would be more accomplishments, as major bills still before the various committees began to emerge onto the floor. The beat of one of the reporters, John Chadwick of the Associated Press, included the Judiciary Committee, however, and Chadwick brought up a bill Johnson had been hoping the press would ignore, proposed liberal legislation to alter the McCarran-Walter Immigration Act. "I don't know anything about it," Johnson replied curtly. "Still in committee." Chadwick, a soft-spoken, notably well-mannered journalist, waited until Johnson had finished discussing the status of other bills, and then returned to the subject, saying, as he was to recall, "Can't you tell us anything about the immigration bill?" And when Johnson replied, "I told you I don't know anything about that, it's still in committee," said, "Well, what's the difference between that bill and all these other bills you've been telling us about? They're still in committee, too." With a violence that another journalist present, William Theiss of International News Service, was to say, shocked the reporters. I'd never seen him lose his cool in public in a way like that. Johnson shouted, "God damn you! Don't you ever tell me how to answer questions! You can get the hell out of here!" Theiss, who felt Johnson was obviously not well, out of control, says he just blew his stack completely. The other reporters defended their colleague for a moment, saying there had been nothing improper about his question, and then, in Theiss's words, broke the thing up right away and left Johnson's office. Stalking out a few minutes later, Johnson went down to the senator's private dining room. Seeing Mike Monroney having lunch there alone, he joined him, bolted down a plate of frankfurters and beans and half a cantaloupe, and got into his limousine. There was one more stop to be made, at the Mayflower, for a visit to Walter George, who had been confined to his apartment with a respiratory infection, and it was 4:45 before Johnson came out, climbed into the back seat of the big limousine, and told Edwards to head for Huntland's. He was alone except for the chauffeur. Lady Bird was later to say that she had remained behind because Saturday was Lucy's birthday and was planning to come down on Sunday. "I remember it suddenly began to seem terribly close, and I told Norman to turn on the air conditioner," Johnson was to say. "He said it was already on, and I said to turn it on full steam, and he said it was already on full steam and was getting very cold." "He was late," Johnson was to say, "and I was trying to make it up, and there was this sense of pressure. My chest hurt." At first he was to say, "I thought to myself, if only I hadn't eaten that cantaloupe at lunch," and "I belched a little and felt better." But as the car headed deeper into the Virginia Hunt country, "my chest really began to hurt. It felt," he was to say, "as though there were 200 pounds on it." By the time he arrived, George Brown was taking a nap, and Posh and Alice were leaving to take a swim in a neighbor's pool. When they asked him to come with him, he said he didn't feel well, that Oltorf recalls, he had terrible indigestion and heartburn. They brought him some baking soda, and he said he felt better and would lie down on a couch in the living room and take a nap, too. As he was lying there, however, "I got this feeling that I couldn't breathe," he was to say. When Posh and Alice returned, George met them at the door. "Lyndon is sick," he said. He had given him more baking soda, "but he says he's got these pains, and I'm worried about him. It might be his heart." At this time, Clinton Anderson, who was on his way to a friend's house in Virginia, dropped by. Lyndon tried to tell Anderson he had indigestion, but Anderson had had a heart attack, and when Johnson mentioned the pressure on his chest and said that his arms felt heavy, he said, "Lyndon, I think you may be having a coronary." "He should see a doctor at once," he said. Johnson's reaction was rage. He was furious about that, Anderson was to say. He didn't want any doctor. He knew there was a story coming out in the Washington Post about him as a possibility for the presidency. He didn't want to knock it in the head, kill it right at the beginning. When Anderson told Brown that a doctor should be called, Brown said, "Now, Clint, Lyndon doesn't want us to do that." As Anderson detailed the similarities between Johnson's symptoms and those of a heart attack victim, Johnson became, in Oltorf's words, more and more frantic. But Anderson insisted that a doctor be called, and Oltorf, who had of course spent a lot of time in the area at Longley, located one, James Gibson of Middleburg, and after Gibson had examined Johnson, he told him that he had the symptoms of a heart attack, and a bad one. The doctor said that there were no local facilities to treat it properly. He knew Johnson was in a great deal of pain, he said, but he suggested that Johnson try to get back to Washington. "You'll probably go into deep shock in about an hour and a half," the doctor said, which just gives us time to get you back into town. That would be the best course, he said, if you feel like you can do it. And then Pa Scholtorf, who had known Lyndon Johnson so long, saw, for the first time, the true strength of Lyndon Johnson. Johnson's usual reaction to physical danger, real or imagined, and to minor pain or illness, was dramatic. At San Marcos, he had had the reputation of being an absolute physical coward, and all during his life after college, whenever he had encountered minor physical problems, the only physical problems Zoltorf had ever seen him encounter, he had become frantic. But there had been other episodes in his life, episodes that Zoltorf had not witnessed. To avoid service in a combat zone during the war, Lyndon Johnson, a reserve officer, had spent months traveling up and down the West Coast on an ostensibly Navy-ordered tour on which the Navy often could not even find out where he was. But when inquiries from constituents and reporters made it imperative that he at least give the appearance of entering a combat zone, he persuaded President Roosevelt, for the sake of political future, as one of Roosevelt's aides wrote, to send him to Australia as an observer. And when, in Australia, he realized that he could not, for the sake of political future, return without at least saying that he had witnessed combat, he flew as an observer on a bombing mission on which his bomber was attacked by Japanese Zeros. It was only a single bombing mission. The next day he left the war zone as quickly as possible. But on that mission, while he was watching Zeros heading straight at his plane, Lyndon Johnson had not been frantic, but cool as a cucumber. Although he had avoided for as long as possible being at the scene of battle, once he was at it, his conduct had been calm and courageous, nonchalant in the face of danger. And of course when, during the 1937 and 1948 campaigns, there had been not minor sickness but grave illness and great pain, Lyndon Johnson had not let it interfere with his work. All his life, whenever courage had been needed, it was there. This, now, the pain in his chest, the heaviness in his arms, the words, heart attack, was what he had always dreaded. But what was required now was calm. And instantly, there was calm. Zoltorf, who had seen Lyndon Johnson complain so often and so loudly about indigestion, now saw a doctor tell Lyndon Johnson that this time the indigestion was a heart attack. And Zoltorf saw Lyndon Johnson's demeanor change. Yes, Johnson told Dr. Gibson, if it was best for him to get to Washington, he could do it. The place to take him, he said, was the Bethesda Naval Hospital. He wanted his people to be at the hospital to meet him, he said, and he told George Brown who they were, and to get them there. Lady Bird, Walter Jenkins, Earl Clements, so that he could give him instructions about the Senate's upcoming work. George Reedy, to handle the press. He wanted someone he knew, someone responsible to him, with him at all times, and he asked Zoltorf to accompany him in the ambulance. When it arrived, Middleburg's ambulance was actually a hearse with the undertaker driving. The doctor took a seat in front, Johnson lay on the floor in the rear, and Zoltorf sat in the rear with him, on a sort of jump seat that pulled out from the wall, so that I was sitting right over him. From that vantage point, Zoltorf saw not only calmness, but courage. The chest pain would come and go, Zoltorf recalls. And about halfway to Washington, it got worse. I can't stand this pain, Lyndon Johnson told the doctor. You've got to give me something for it. The doctor said, I can give you a shot if you want, but we'll have to stop, and it's going to take some time, and time means a lot to you. If time means a lot, don't stop, Lyndon Johnson said. Keep going. It was a very hectic ride, Zoltorf was to say. It hurt him desperately. But between bouts of pain, he and Zoltorf talked. It was an amazing conversation, Zoltorf felt. He was extremely courageous and brave. I always thought, you know, that if he had a toe ache, he'd complain about it and expect a great deal of sympathy. He was just the opposite with this serious thing. Zoltorf watched him running over things in his mind. I think he definitely felt there was a possibility that he'd die before he got there, Zoltorf says. And at one point, he reached up to me and said, Posh, if something happens, I want to tell you where I think my will is. He said he thought it was in the bottom drawer of his desk at the radio station in Austin, that he had drawn it up when he went off to war and had not seen it in a long time, but thought that it was there. If it's not, he said, I just want to tell you what I want. I want Lady Bird to have everything I have. She's been a wonderful, wonderful wife, and she's done so much for me. She just deserves everything I have. That's what was in my will." There was another matter Johnson mentioned, and Oldtorff did not allude to it in the oral history he gave the Lyndon Johnson Library, although he included it, or at least part of it, in his interview with the author. Then he asked me, did I ever see Alice Glass? That was something he very seldom asked me, and I said I saw her off and on. He said, how is she? And I said, all right. And then he said something I didn't tell you, and I don't think I'm going to. And there was another important matter. Doctor, he said, let me ask you something. Will I be able to smoke again if this is a heart attack? The doctor said, well, Senator, frankly, no. And Johnson, with what Oldtorff recalls as a great sigh, said, I'd rather have my pecker cut off. At the emergency room entrance to Bethesda, attendants lifted Johnson onto a stretcher and carried him into an elevator, which took them up to the 17th floor cardiac treatment section. Lady Bird, Walter Jenkins, and George Reedy were in a waiting room there. Clements had not been located. And they saw Johnson carried past its doorway into an examining room, and doctors took them to the private room he would have as a patient. After about a half hour, he was brought in and lifted onto the bed. He looked very, very bad, Walter Jenkins says. Johnson said the doctors had told him he had had a serious heart attack, and that they would be coming to put him under in a few minutes. Lady Bird was Lady Bird. She didn't break down or cry or carry on or anything of that nature, as some women do, Jenkins says. It's not her nature to do that. She just said, honey, everything will be all right. Johnson told Reedy to notify the press about the attack, and not to minimize its seriousness, to tell them it was a real belly-buster, and that Clements would take over for him. He gave Reedy instructions for Clements. He told Jenkins where his will was, and reminded him about the cash in the secret compartment in his desk, and told him to give it to Lady Bird. I really felt that he did not think he would live through the night, Jenkins would recall. He was preparing himself for not being there any more. He told Lady Bird to stay with him in the hospital, not to leave him. He handed her his wallet and keys. He mentioned the two suits he had ordered that morning. Tell him to go ahead with the blue, he said. We can use that no matter what happens. He asked for a cigarette, and when Lady Bird said he couldn't smoke any more, he said if he could have one last cigarette, he would never have another. Someone handed him one. It was very sensuous, Mrs. Johnson recalls. He looked at it like, this is the dearest thing. Then he went into shock. Mrs. Johnson saw him turn gray, just about the color of pavement. He was motionless as stone and cold to touch. After a while, the doctors came to see her. They said her husband had had a very serious heart attack, that his chances were fairly good, but that only time would tell. The first 24 hours, they said, would be critical. Chapter 28. Memories. Lyndon Johnson had suffered a myocardial infarction, the death or damage, infarction, of part of the muscular substance of the heart, myocardium, because the flow of blood to the heart had been interrupted by a blockage of an artery. He was kept sedated for 48 hours, but there were intervals of consciousness, during one of which it became apparent that sedation had not dulled his ability to obtain information that someone did not want to give him. Lady Bird may have been determined not to let him know the doctor's estimate of his chances of survival during this initial period following the attack, but he got the information from her anyway. She had been sitting almost constantly at his bedside, but she left the room for a few minutes, and when she returned, he spoke as if doctors had visited him during her absence. "I've just heard the bad news," he said. "What news? What do you mean?" she said. "I know the doctors feel I only have 1 chance in 10 of pulling through." "Nonsense," she blurted out. "They say it's 50-50. With this type of heart attack, however, the patient's chance of survival increases dramatically with each day he survives without another attack and without increased damage to the heart from the first attack. And by the fourth day, although he was still permitted no visitors other than his wife, doctors told the press that while the majority leader had suffered a myocardial infarction of a moderately severe character, X-rays had shown no further damage to the heart. His condition is stabilized, and he is resting comfortably. He was quite critically ill following the attack, but his recovery has been satisfactory, they said. Any immediate return to work was out of the question, the statement said. He cannot undertake any business whatsoever for a period of months. However, if there are no further attacks of a severe character and his recovery continues to be satisfactory, he should be able to return to the Senate in January. The damage to his chances of reaching his great goal appeared for some time, however, to be as severe as he had feared it would be when Clinton Anderson had first told him he was having a coronary. The immediate political casualty of the majority leader's heart attack is the Johnson boom for president, which previously had been coming along on schedule, Doris Fleeson wrote. And in the days following the 4th of July weekend, the prevailing view in newspaper articles and columns was that the damage might well be permanent. A headline over an Associated Press analysis said, "Heart attack drops Johnson from White House hopefuls." And in an era before the later dramatic advances in the understanding and treatment of heart disease, that analysis did not apply merely to 1956. Although when he recovers he may have a long and useful life as a senator, uncertainty is the greatest certainty about the life of a man who has had an attack, the article declared. Anyone who has had an attack and seeks the presidency starts under a political handicap. The voters are conscious of the risk in picking him over an opponent who has never had his first heart attack. Johnson's attack, therefore, just about eliminates the 46-year-old Texan, permanently, from consideration as a presidential candidate. Some journalists speculated that the attack might eliminate him from the leadership as well. While the doctors had said Johnson should be able to return to the Senate, they had declined to express such optimism about a return to the leadership. It might be 6 months before it would be possible to say whether he could resume the leadership, one of his physicians said. The AP said it is questionable that when he returns his doctors will let him resume as Senate leader, preferring he go back to the less demanding role of senator. Lyndon Johnson fell into a depression. The doctors had told Walter Jenkins and George Reedy that depression was common among heart attack victims, but they also told the two aides that this one seemed unusually severe. Jenkins says he understood why. He felt if he had any chance to be president or vice president or something, that this had ended it. He became quite despondent at times. Neither antidepressant medication nor the arrival of his mother, whose trip to Washington was her first airplane flight, seemed to help. For some days he lay in his bed, just wouldn't talk, wouldn't have anything to do with anyone, in Jenkins's words, while his centrality in his assistants' lives was traumatized. Bobby Baker got the news over the telephone at the New Jersey seashore, where he was vacationing with friends. Returning from the telephone, he was, recalls one friend, white as a sheet. "The leader's had a heart attack," he said. Rushing to Bethesda, he was told that Johnson was allowed no visitors except Lady Bird. He went down to the lobby and waited, day after day. "For almost 10 days I stayed at the hospital almost around the clock, leaving only to grab a few random hours of sleep and to take showers," he was to recall. "Though there was little I could do, I felt it my duty to be there." Once he went down to the Capitol to see Sam Rayburn, seeking solace, but didn't get any. Speaker Rayburn was disconsolate and near tears. And when finally, some days after Baker had returned to work at the Capitol, Lady Bird telephoned to say that Lyndon wanted to see him, Baker found a quiet and sober man who talked of how close he'd come to death, of how he would be forced to curtail his activities, and of how he might no longer be able to act as Senate Majority Leader. Saying he might resign from the Senate, he asked Baker if he would resign too and manage a radio station in Brownsville he was thinking of buying. "You're my leader, and I'll follow where you lead," Baker replied. And then, one day, Reedy's telephone rang, and it was Jenkins. "For the love of God, do you know what's happening?" Walter asked him, and told him to go to the hospital. And Reedy recalls, "When I got to the hospital, I couldn't believe it." Letters, almost 4,000 of them, had been pouring into Johnson's office from friends and the public, and Lady Bird had been reading them to him. For days, Johnson had shown little response. And then, one morning, immediately upon awakening, he had told Lady Bird that he wanted the letters answered. All of them, Each answered, not with a form letter, but with a personalized note. Lady Bird should send handwritten notes to personal friends, he said, and as for the rest, he told her to have Booth Mooney come to the hospital, and when Mooney arrived, he had a project for me, a project Mooney was to call Project Impossible. We're going to answer all of them, Johnson said. Everyone has to have a personal reply. And when Mooney, aghast, 4,000 letters, tried to protest, saying that all the newspaper people know you're not up to dictating letters, it would look fake, Johnson said he had figured out a way around that problem. The letters would be signed by Lady Bird, he said. Mooney would dictate them at the office, and after they had been typed, would bring them out to the hospital for her to sign. Make them short, just a few lines, but tender and grateful, Johnson said. And, Johnson said, he had a few letters he wanted to dictate himself. A stenographer should be sent out from his office. By the time Reedy arrived at the hospital, a desk had been set up in Lady Bird's room next to Lyndon's, and she was writing at it as fast as she could. Two or three stenographers were sitting at the physician's station in the corridor, and they were out there with those typewriters going full blast. He took over the corridor, installed a couple of typewriters there. He was dictating letters. He was just going full speed. His physicians, J.C. Kane of the Mayo Clinic and cardiologist Willis Hurst, had prescribed complete rest with absolutely no excitement, and had banned radio, television, and newspapers from his room. That morning, Johnson had told Hurst that he missed country music and had asked for a radio so he could listen to some. Hurst agreed, on condition that Johnson not listen to any news broadcasts. Once he had the radio, of course, Johnson listened only to the news, switching from station to station. One radio was not enough. He got a second, a small transistor with earphones, so that he could listen to two newscasts at once. And when a newscaster's wording did not please him, he shouted back at the radio, and, as Reedy put it, his nurses reported that they almost immediately acquired larger vocabularies. A television set was installed in his room. A visitor found him simultaneously watching TV, listening to the news through an earphone receiver on a tiny transistor radio, and carrying on a lively conversation with a nurse. Visitors from the political world had also been banned, but Johnson insisted that Reedy and Jenkins be constantly on call, and then Rayburn was sent for, and Russell, and Earl Clements. The Senate wasn't doing much in his absence, but, Jenkins says, he really kept his oar in the sense of being certain that he understood what was going on. Not that, as Reedy explains, Clements was trying to make the Senate do much. By that time, the Lyndon Johnson legend had become so overpowering that I pity anybody that had to step into his shoes. Baker was sent for again, and this time when he arrived, his leader was the leader again, demanding that I bring him all the news and gossip. Who was absent from roll calls? Who'd been drunk recently? Tell Senator Kerr this, tell Speaker Rayburn that. Bring me a copy of this committee report or that congressional record. Johnson seemed pleased when I told him that not much was happening in the Senate, that it was conducting a mere holding action until he could return to work. One day, Baker was rushing down the 17th-floor corridor toward Johnson's room, his arms filled with papers he had demanded, when he encountered Rayburn, who had just been in to visit the patient. His old face split into a rare grin, Baker recalls. I'm happy to see you taking him all that work, the speaker said. It would kill him if he relaxed. I know he's getting better because he fussed at me. And Project Impossible had proved possible after all. On July 18th, the Jenkins memo told Johnson, "We in the office know that having all your mail answered means more to you than any gift which we would give you. Therefore, we have stayed here tonight to see that every letter is answered and filed. I am glad to report all of the letters about your illness, almost 4,000 to date, have now been answered." Johnson had also decided to have letters written to the publishers of every newspaper that had carried a complimentary editorial about him during his illness, and to have those editorials inserted in the congressional record. That also had been done. More and more visitors came, including some from the GOP, like Noland and Bridges. Dr. Hurst had tried to set a limit on the number of visitors per day, but when he told Johnson that the limit had been exceeded, Johnson replied, "Oh, now look, doctor, you're not going to count Republicans, are you?" One day the door opened, and the president was standing there, his great smile beaming into the room. "Why, Lyndon," Ike said, "you look a lot better than I thought you would." The vice president came, for what had been intended as a brief visit but which lasted for more than an hour, as Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson fell into a serious conversation, one that was to mark the beginning of a close relationship between the two future presidents, which is only now beginning to be glimpsed by historians. One rule on which Hearst had insisted was that no more than two visitors be in Johnson's room at a time. And one day, Harry Byrd sat patiently on a bench in the 17th floor corridor for more than 30 minutes, while Sid Richardson and Richardson's lobbyist, Bill Cottrell, were talking inside. Hearst and Kane did not object to Johnson's activity because, alarmed by the depth of his depression, they had had a long discussion with Lady Byrd, and as a result they had a better understanding of their patient and of his inability to do anything in moderation. If he was sitting on the porch at the LBJ Ranch whittling toothpicks, he'd have to whittle more than anybody else in the country, Dr. Kane was to say. They explained to Reedy that, in Reedy's words, to cut down his schedule would be worse than adding to it, because his psychology was such that the frustrations of idleness would be more likely than work to lead to another heart attack. And for a while, as he turned the 17th floor of the Bethesda Medical Center into an uproar, Lyndon Johnson was his old self. As Jenkins wrote to Mary Rather on July 23rd, "Mary, you would be real happy if you could see how well the senator is getting along. He is just as cheerful and chipper as he can be." Lyndon Johnson's old self had been characterized by violent mood swings, however, and they persisted in the hospital, so that from day to day Jenkins and others on his staff would not know whether they would find Johnson cheerful and chipper, or lying flat on his back in his bed, speaking only in monosyllables and monotone, unwilling to take an interest in anything anyone told him. One antidote to his depression was the letters and editorials. Sitting next to his bed, Lady Byrd read them to him. She put the best of them into acetate sheets in gold-tooled leather scrapbooks and left them beside the bed. And Lyndon Johnson read them. He spent hours reading them, in Reedy's words, over and over and over again, putting his fingers on them as if he needed to touch them, becoming, in Reedy's words, absolutely obsessive about them. In a way, Reedy and Jenkins and Mooney felt, his illness had deepened his lifelong need for reassurance that he was loved, and the letters and editorials seemed to assuage that longing. There was sort of an unspoken yearning of his that could be felt all the way down to the Senate for that kind of reassurance, and he got it, Reedy says. Oh, he was just basking in those letters. The Senate had stood for a moment of silent prayer for him on the first day it met following his attack. Herbert Lehman had asked it to do so. And then there had been one laudatory speech about him after another. Lady Byrd had told him about these eulogies at the time, but he hadn't seemed interested. She had put the pages of the Congressional Record containing the speeches in a scrapbook. And now he read them, slowly, carefully, devouring every word. And there were letters from senators. "Give Lyndon my best," Harry Byrd wrote to Lady Byrd. "Tell him the Senate is not the same without him." The longest letter was from Humphrey, of course. It said in part, "I miss having you get after me. I miss your good humor. Yes, we're just lonesome for you." One day, Johnson said with a grin, "Everybody loves Lyndon, I found out." And then, in a lower, very serious, almost unbelieving tone, "Nobody run out and left me." The other antidote was the woman who read him the letters and editorials. When he had arrived at the hospital that first night and the doctors were about to put him under, he had said to his wife, in a voice that Walter Jenkins says was the pleading voice of a small boy, "Stay with me, Bird." When the next day he emerged for a moment from the sedation, he said it again, "Stay with me, Bird." She did. She was there, sitting by the bed, when he woke. Every time he woke. "Lyndon wanted me around him 24 hours a day," she was to recall, and that's how many hours she was there. At first, her friend Ruth Montgomery was to write, Byrd would not leave him even long enough to go out for a meal. It was a week before her friends Eugene and Anne Worley persuaded her to go out to a restaurant. Anne Worley would never forget how, when Lady Byrd first saw them, she said, optimistically, as if to convince herself, "Everything's going to be fine." She would never forget how determinedly gay and cheerful Byrd was all that evening. She would never forget the smile that never left her face. Her husband would remain at Bethesda for 5 weeks, periodically falling back into that terrible depression, a pit of despair so dark that at times Jenkins did fear that he would kind of give up, maybe wouldn't make the effort to recover. I thought maybe he would just say, "This is it, I've had it." For a few days, Jenkins says, Johnson would be all right, but then he'd have these periods. The doses of despondency medicine would resume, and then he'd be all right for a while, and then he'd have another period of despondency. During those 5 weeks, Lady Bird Johnson left the hospital to go to her home, where, of course, there were an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old daughter living, exactly twice. During those 5 weeks in the hospital, Lyndon Johnson was displaying other characteristics that had been prominent features of his old life. One was that incredible will. Cigarettes, 60 cigarettes or more each day, lit one from the end of another, had been so desperately important to him for so long. Now Kane and Hurst confirmed what Dr. Gibson had told him in the ambulance. The smoking must stop immediately and completely. Lyndon Johnson tore the wrapper off a pack of cigarettes, opened the pack, and pulled one cigarette halfway out of it. Then he put the pack on the night table next to his hospital bed, and the pack stayed there, open but untouched, the cigarette sticking out, for the rest of his hospital stay. When he got home, he put a pack on his night table there, and there would be another one next to his bed on the ranch, and they all remained untouched. Once in 1958, one of his secretaries, Ashton Ganella, asked him if he didn't miss smoking. "Every minute of every day," he replied. But except for occasional lapses, all seemed to have involved no more than a cigarette or two, Lyndon Johnson did not smoke another cigarette for 15 years. Not until, in 1970, he had retired from the presidency and was back permanently on his ranch, when he began smoking copiously again. If there was another substance that had been as important to him as nicotine, it was caffeine. From breakfast, which had often consisted of several cigarettes and several cups of black coffee, through the rest of his day, he had seemed, in Jenkins's words, to live on cigarettes and coffee. Now, since caffeine was dangerous for heart attack victims, he was told to cut out caffeinated coffee, too, and he did, completely, drinking only decaffeinated. He had to cut out a lot more. Excess weight is a burden on the heart, and doctors told him he should weigh about 185, which would mean losing about 40 pounds. So he went on a diet, with Johnsonian thoroughness, the thoroughness of a man who believed in doing everything. He announced he would lose even more weight than the doctors wanted, saying he would get down below 180 by reducing his daily intake of calories not to the 2,000 the doctors had recommended, but to 1,500. And Reedy says, "He became the goddamnedest diet fanatic that ever lived." To make sure he kept the calories below that figure, he insisted that on every tray brought to him at the hospital there be a list of the calories in each dish on it. And since studies had begun showing that, as one article put it, a fatty substance known as cholesterol is suspect in connection with heart disease, the list must, he said, include a count not only of the calories but of the fat grams in each dish. The responsibility for the list was assigned to Lady Bird, who for years thereafter would be referred to by some irreverent members of the Johnson staff as the keeper of the weight. And her husband tolerated no mistakes. Since he couldn't seem to make himself eat small portions, although the portions were notably smaller than before, it was important that he eat foods very low in calories, and since a slice of cantaloupe contains only 45 calories, he became, as Jenkins says, a cantaloupe nut. Once his tray arrived with a slice of watermelon instead, and he asked how many calories it contained, and, as Reedy recalls, Bird incautiously said 65, and he insisted they look it up. And when it turned out to contain 145, you would have thought that the world had come to an end or he'd been betrayed. Sometimes determining the fat grams was difficult. "I'm either going to have to turn registered chemist or jump out the window," Lady Bird said. But his methods worked. "I've given up eating and smoking at the same time," he said, "and if any of you all have tried giving up just one of them, you'll know how hard giving up both could be." But by the time he left the hospital and returned to 30th Place on August 7th, to be greeted by a group of neighbors standing on his front lawn, a welcome home telegram from J. Edgar Hoover, who was out of town, and an enthusiastic welcome from Little Beagle Johnson, He weighed 179. For the remainder of the year, as he rested at his Washington home until August 25th, and then, 2 days before his 47th birthday, went back to the ranch in Texas for a four-month stay, reporters were told that Lyndon Johnson was resting, concentrating on regaining his health, and that he had learned to relax, that he had changed his philosophy of life. His illness was dramatized with the customary Johnson flair. Reporters who interviewed him in Washington and then at the ranch found him talking in slow, calm phrases, interrupted by frequent pauses, and walking, as one article reported, with agonizingly slow steps. But so was the fact that, he said, doctors had assured him that if he took care of himself, he would recover from the illness and be able to return to his duties, to all his duties, as good as new. He wanted, therefore, to create the image of a prudent man taking care of himself, and he made sure reporters understood that he was doing so. He told them how much he had weighed when he had stepped on the scale that morning, emphasized that he was getting his weight down even lower than the doctors had ordered. The doctors had told him to take a nap every day. He took two naps, he said. The doctors had told him to get plenty of sleep at night. Even here, as one article reported, he tried to beat par. When the doctor told him to get 8 hours sleep a night, Lyndon insisted on getting nine. And he said he had resolved never to go back to his old driving ways. "I've thrown out the whip." In fact, he said, he had developed a whole new philosophy of life, which was codified in an article, "My Heart Attack Taught Me How to Live," written by Horace Busby, which appeared over his byline in the American magazine, and in dozens of interviews with reporters. "During nearly 25 years of political life, I drove myself and others at headlong pace," the article said. "I never learned how to relax. Now," he said, "I've got something I never had before in my life, something I always wanted, too, and that is time." And, he said, he had learned to use that time. "It took a heart attack to make me cut my cloth to the pattern of contentment God has given me, but now I know the lesson well," he said. "I began consciously looking for some of the good things I had been missing." One of those good things, he said, was nature. "He loved to walk in plowed fields, just to feel the dirt under my feet," he said. "He loved to walk down the road with a view of my fat cows grazing on the one side and my beautiful river flowing on the other." Another of the good things, high on the list of those good things, he said, was getting acquainted with my two daughters. They had come to be 11 and 8 years of age, and I hardly knew them at all. For example, I had always been too busy to join with the girls in observing their birthdays. Now, he said, there was time to get to know them, and I found myself falling into a happy relationship with Linda Bird and Lucy Baines. They played dominoes together, took turns reading aloud from their books, and he found, he said, why they liked me. On Sunday mornings, he said, after a leisurely, chatty breakfast, little Lucy suddenly threw her arms around my neck and hugged me hard. "Daddy," she said, "it sure is nice to have you around the house so much." He portrayed his new life as one of reading and thoughtful contemplation. Although in truth his refusal to read books was as adamant as ever, plenty were scattered about, some of them open as if he had just put them down, when reporters arrived for interviews. Booth Mooney recalls that stories began to appear which I scanned in utter disbelief. The Johnson who once had admitted, or even boasted, that he doubted if he had read as many as half a dozen books all the way through since leaving college, was said now to be deep into Plato, not to mention innumerable volumes of American history. After interviewing Johnson in his bedroom at 30th Place, Mary McGrory reported that there are books all over the room, including Plato's Republic and Machiavelli's The Prince, and the senator is taking the unusual opportunity to do a little reading. As the months passed, his thirst for the arts appeared to broaden. Arriving at the ranch for an interview in October, Newsweek's Sam Schaffer found Johnson sprawled in a hammock, a book on his lap. Strauss waltzes floated into the air from a record player. As he talked to Schaffer, he touched the book on his lap and recalled that he'd always been too busy to read books before. He probably hadn't read more than 6 all the way through from the day he left college until the day of the heart attack. and now he was reading that many a week. He listened to the music and said, "You know, until the attack, I just never listened to music. I don't know why, I just didn't." Lady Bird chimed in, telling another reporter that Lyndon was reading innumerable history and biographies. "He certainly was," Lyndon said. At that moment, he was deep into Douglas Southall Freeman's massive three-volume Lee's Lieutenants, and enjoying it immensely. "And it was wonderful," he said, with a deeply thoughtful expression, "to have time at last just to sit and think." The image he wanted was the image he got. Sarah McClendon wrote of his new easy-going, relaxed peace. Mary McGrory, noting that a man who has been in a hurry all my life is learning to slow down, and that he is something of a model patient, added, "It would perhaps be too much to say that the senator is finding sweet the uses of adversity, but there have been advantages." But in reality, he wasn't resting, and he wasn't relaxing, and he wasn't at peace. He couldn't be, particularly not back on the ranch. He took off on Wesley West's private jet, whose owner he declined to name, from bustling National Airport outside Washington, but he landed at the tiny Fredericksburg airport, which consisted only of a landing strip, a windsock, and a shed that was used as an office. There, representatives of both local newspapers and the United Press were on hand to chronicle in story and picture the return home of the famous native son. And also present was a shocked Mary Rather, who was to recall that, as she watched him come off the plane, "He was the thinnest thing you have ever seen, and his clothes were just hanging on him." And of course Mrs. Johnson looked bad, too. Ranch hands had a station wagon there, and they drove him along the Pedernales Valley, with the houses further and further apart, to the ranch. And there, on the first morning, he was awakened at dawn by the mooing of a cow demanding to be milked, the same sound that had awakened him on the ranch as a boy. And instantly Lyndon Johnson was back in his first home, back ill on the ranch where his father had been ill, and where his father, who had had such great dreams, had failed. Back on the ranch where his grandfather, whose saddlebags had once been filled with gold, had come to live out his life in poverty after his great dreams had been brought to nothing. Back on the ranch where the heroine Eliza Bunton Johnson, who had dared to ride out ahead of the herd to scout, had come back to live when she was old, old and poor and paralyzed, with a stroke-twisted face that lived in Lyndon's nightmares. Sometimes in the morning he would walk along the river to the Johnson family graveyard, and there, under the spreading branches of a big live oak, inside a rickety little fence, were the tombstones of Eliza Bunton Johnson, Sam Ely Johnson Sr., and Sam Ely Johnson Jr. He would stand there for long minutes, staring at the names. And one morning, thinking that no one was watching him, Lyndon Johnson drew with his shoe an X in the ground in that graveyard, the spot for his own grave. His brother, Sam Houston Johnson, had come back from Washington to live at the ranch that summer, so Lyndon was back with that broken, wretched man. Josepha was living in Fredericksburg, so he was back with the sister who had brought the family into even deeper disgrace. He was back with his mother, who kept telling people how much like his father he was. If he walked past the graveyard, he soon came to the site of the house in which he had been born, on which another battered, ramshackle, dog-run cabin now stood. Lyndon Johnson painted, and journalists repainted, a picture of a relaxed, almost idyllic existence on the tranquil banks of the Pedernales. But the reality was far different. "It was way out in the country, and it was so quiet and still," Mary Rather was to recall. "And during the first few weeks, it was a real quiet, long, lonesome, sad kind of a fall." His nightmares came back, worse than ever. "They got worse after my heart attack," he was to tell Doris Kearns Goodwin. And not long after his arrival, he fell into a despair deeper even than his despair in the hospital. For a week, Lyndon Johnson sat in the big recliner in the ranch's rock-walled living room, the chair tilted all the way back so that as he slouched down in it, he was lying almost flat, with his feet at the level of his head. He would sit there for hours, staring at nothing and saying nothing. When someone, his wife or daughters, attempted to engage him in conversation, he would reply in monosyllables or not at all. little Beagle Johnson would jump up and lie in his lap. From time to time he would lick Lyndon Johnson's face, wagging his tail frenziedly and barking. There would be no response. As the dog licked his face, his master wouldn't even move. Dr. Hurst, who had begun to understand his patient, had warned Mary Rather that, in her words, "Some days he might want to see the mail that came in, and the next day I might have it all ready for him, and he wouldn't look at it." Ms. Rather, who knew the talismanic significance that the mail held for her boss, had not taken Hurst seriously, but the doctor's prediction turned out to be correct. For a day or two, Johnson refused even to pick up the telephone when Walter Jenkins called to give him the news from Washington. She told Sam Houston, "He's going into a very deep depression, and we don't know what it is." Sam Houston, who knew his brother so well, knew what it was. I said, "Well, if you had one office you aspired to all your life, and..." And he knew what the cure was, the only cure. Telephoning the nationally syndicated political columnist Holmes Alexander, a close friend, he asked him to write a column saying that the heart attack would not prevent Lyndon Johnson from becoming president. When Alexander demurred, Sam Houston recalls, I said, "Here I've been giving you scoops for years. If you can't take a chance on helping me save my brother, then the hell with you." Alexander agreed to write it, and on September 1st, there in the Austin American Statesman were the magic words, "The senator is now almost restored in health. He is a serious candidate for the Democratic nomination, either in 1956 or 1960, depending on which is more propitious. It's hard to see how the party so united in praising him when he was ill can divide against him now that he's bushy-tailed and ambitious once more. This may be the first time in history that a man was virtually nominated by his press clippings." Sam Houston gave the column to his brother as he lay on the recliner, and not long thereafter the Beagle jumped up on Lyndon's lap and went into one of his face-licking, tail-wagging, barking frenzies. And after a while, Lyndon Johnson laughed, the first laugh Mary Rather had heard him utter since he arrived at the ranch, and went for a walk. And that same day brought another development. At Jim Rowe's suggestion, Johnson had decided before the heart attack to put on his staff a new assistant, one who would be a living reminder of his early link with Franklin Roosevelt, which Johnson considered essential to mending his fences with liberals. Now that assistant would be a reminder also that Roosevelt had suffered a serious illness but had become president nonetheless. And when Grace Tully arrived in Texas, she knew just what to say. Many things about the senator reminded her of FDR, one article reported. For example, Roosevelt had been deeply interested in conservation and natural resources. And Johnson's improvements to his ranch show that he, too, takes a great interest in the land. "Johnson aide says Texan is like FDR," proclaimed a headline in the San Antonio Express. There would be other spells of depression while Johnson was in Texas, but none as serious as the first one. During Lyndon Johnson's remaining months on the ranch in 1955, there was no recurrence of the heart problem, no pain or any other symptom. The bottle of digitalis, a heart stimulant that doctors had given him in case of another attack, remained unopened next to the pack of cigarettes on his night table. For the rest of Lyndon Johnson's life, however, he lived in terror of another heart attack. He never wanted to sleep alone, so that there would always be someone to help him if he suffered an attack during the night. And if Ladybird was away, he would dragoon an aide or a friend into sleeping in the same room with him. Years later, in the White House, asking an assistant, Vicki McCammon, and her husband to stay overnight, he would insist that they sleep in Ladybird's dressing room next door to his bedroom. "The only deal is you've got to leave your door open a crack so that if I holler, someone will hear me." But that fear wasn't as strong as the fears, born of his boyhood insecurities and humiliations, that haunted him throughout his life. Now he was back on the ranch that was a constant reminder of those boyhood fears, and he fled from them as desperately as ever, more desperately, in fact. During the rest of his months on the ranch, the sad, quiet spells of depression alternated with periods of frantic activity. During these frenzied periods, he poured himself into recovering his health. Following doctors' orders to get plenty of rest was easy on the isolated ranch. The Johnsons and their staff kept farm hours, going to sleep at 9 and rising early, when the cows started to moo. The rural mail carrier left the mail and the morning newspapers in the box across the Pernalis around 6 a.m., and Mary Rather would walk across the concrete bridge to bring them back. Every afternoon there was the long nap, and Johnson spent a lot of additional time lying in the recliner. The doctors had told him to relax. Massages relaxed him, so his favorite masseur from the Senate Gymnasium, Olaf Anderson, was dispatched to Texas and installed at the ranch for the duration. The sun relaxed him, so he would spend hours lying in the sun with his shirt off, his pale skin gradually turning bronze. The doctors had told him to get plenty of exercise, and specifically to walk a mile each evening after dinner. Using a pedometer, he measured various walks he might take. The little home of his elderly spinster cousin, Oriole Bunton Bailey, he determined, was just over a half mile away, so if he visited her each evening, he would be doing more than the doctor ordered. Those walks became a legend among Johnson's staff. Oh, he loved to talk to Cousin Oriole about old times and kid her about her boyfriends, which she didn't have, just tease her. This pastime was less enjoyable to his staffers than to him, but he insisted that everyone accompany him on the walks and stand around while he shouted at the elderly lady in the faded Mother Hubbard. She appeared to be, Jenkins recalls, about as stone-deaf as you could be, and then walk back. For additional exercise, a kidney-shaped swimming pool was built in the front yard of the ranch house. It was a Johnsonian pool, large, 9 feet deep at the deep end, expensive, personally supervised. Every shovelful, George Reedy says, that swimming pool became one of the great construction projects of history. Equipped with every technological innovation, including a huge elaborate heater, kept constantly at full blast, that kept the pool as warm as a bathtub because he did not like cold water. I myself hated that pool, Reedy says. I didn't go into it unless he absolutely forced me into it because I want water to be cold. And surrounded by a lawn of grass as smooth and lush as a carpet. Telephone outlets make it possible for Johnson to conduct business neck-deep in the warm water while piped-in music, from speakers placed in the live oaks, soothes his nerves and those of his guests, and while secretaries and assistants scurry about the pool, obeying an endless stream of instructions, one visiting journalist reported. Strauss waltzes were played only when journalists were present. At other times, the repertoire was strictly elevator music. How much exercise the pool gave him is doubtful. Aside from a few side-stroke laps every day, he spent most of his time in it in a floating reclining chair, a drink in his hand. But it did give him a new means of control. Reedy, at least, was tall, other assistants were shorter, and when Johnson was swimming with a shorter assistant, he would wait until the assistant was at the deep end of the pool, and then stop and stand still while he was between the assistant and the shallower water. Years later, 5-foot-10-inch Joseph Califano, newly attached to the White House staff, would describe how President Johnson outlined a multi-part domestic program in the pool with his finger poking my shoulder as though it were punctuating a series of exclamation points. I nodded, treading. He was so close to me, almost nose to nose, that I couldn't move around him so I could stand on the bottom of the pool. I was breathless from treading water as his finger against my shoulder kept pushing me down. Not until months later, as I got to know him, did I realize that for this early exchange, Lyndon Johnson had instinctively and intentionally picked a depth of the pool where he could stand and I had to tread water. Johnson spent hours lying on an immense chaise lounge that had been placed beside the pool, sipping lemonade made with sugarless sweeteners, and yelling, "Bird! Bird!" into an intercom in a voice that one visitor likened to a hog call whenever he wanted something. Then there was the diet, and as time passed it grew increasingly difficult to keep Johnson on it. A dietitian, Juanita Roberts, was brought to the ranch and installed there, and she devised dishes, a low-fat tapioca pudding made with sucarill, for example, with which Johnson could cram himself without ingesting many calories. His weight stayed between 175 and 180. Lady Bird had to supervise this area of his activity, too. "When this is over," she told a friend, "I want to go off by myself and cry for about 2 hours." "Lyndon might get along all right," she wrote another friend. "I don't know whether I'll make it or not." and he poured himself into the recovery of his career. Part of the day was rest, but the remainder was politics as usual, the Lyndon Johnson brand of politics. Wanting, in Reedy's words, to generate attention, keep people aware of his presence, he began dictating letters to Lady Bird and Mary Rather, dictating so many that they couldn't keep up with him, and they were joined by a recent addition to the staff, Mary Margaret Wiley, a 26-year-old University of Texas graduate, dictating so many that the three women working at card tables set up in the rock-walled living room couldn't type them up in the perfect style he wanted fast enough, or to cross-index them for the files, and the letters were sent off for typing. On new stationery with pretty typewriter, hurry please. In big packages to the larger staff in the Washington office, which also couldn't keep up. The letters were to foes as well as allies, and all were written with the Johnson touch. Dear John, I've been sitting here on my ranch looking over the country in which I was born and just relaxing and enjoying myself thoroughly. Every prospect pleases except one, the distance from my close personal friends in the Senate. One of the reasons that I'm so very anxious to recover completely is so I can return to Washington in January as good as new and thank all of my friends on both sides of the aisle. One of the first hands I want to shake is that of John W. Bricker. He began telephoning, and was soon demanding that the calls be stacked up waiting for him. So many new telephone lines had to be installed that the long cords grew tangled on the living room floor. To the clatter of typewriters, a clatter which, a visitor says, never seemed to stop, that drifted out of the open windows of the living room and down across the lawn and the meadow to the placid Purdon Alice, was added the ringing of telephones, a ringing that also never seemed to stop. The stacks of letters and telegrams on the card tables grew higher. A former secretary, Dorothy Palmy of Austin, who had been reading in the newspapers about the calm, restful atmosphere at the ranch, drove out for a visit, and found him going full blast. Mary Rather and Lady Bird were beating their brains out with all these little details and tasks and chores. A team headed by Reedy set up an office in the United States Courthouse in Austin. Jenkins remained in Washington with the rest of the staff, and the three offices were in constant communication. By mid-September, the reports from the Senate Preparedness Investigating Subcommittee began to flow again, as did the glowing promises of future reports. Watch for the SPSC to try to make headlines this fall with a searching probe of undue cuts in the Defense Department's aircraft and missile programs, Newsweek's Periscope declared. Senator Lyndon Johnson is personally laying out the agenda for this while recuperating in Texas. And the leaks. Reedy in Austin to Siegel in Washington. I had another talk with the senator about reporter Jack Anderson, and I think we should do something for him as soon as possible. Can you find anything in the Preparedness Committee files that I could slip to Jack in a hurry and that would make him a pretty good story? I think that we could make some real hay with Jack. And other means of influencing the press, including the orchestration of a spontaneous letter-writing campaign to try, unsuccessfully, to persuade Time magazine that Lyndon Johnson should be its Man of the Year. The planted stories began again. Dear Senator, all right, I have followed your instructions. I've just finished and mailed to Texas a 5-page story on Grace Tully, affectionately Liz. As did the pressures on government officials for favors for Johnson's friends. With the loneliness becoming unbearable to him, Johnson began to invite visitors to the ranch, senators and journalists, and others important to him. The first visitors would be Adlai Stevenson, still the leading candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, who was going to speak at the University of Texas on September 29th, and Sam Rayburn, who would introduce him. The two men had agreed to drive out to the Johnson Ranch after the speech and spend the night. So many people were invited that the 5 upstairs bedrooms, several of which were already occupied by staff members, would not be sufficient. While the pool was still being built, another construction project was begun, a 4-room guest house. Johnson had, furthermore, resumed, as avidly as ever, his quest for money. He did it with his customary circumspection. When E.L. Kurth gave him a prize Brahma bull named Johnson's Manso, the papers were sent not to him but to A.W. Morsund, and Morsund was at the ranch almost every day. and he did it with his customary energy. During this period, while he was publicly proclaiming, over and over, his devotion to rest and relaxation, he was working at a headlong pace to add new advertising revenues for his radio and television stations, calling Edwin Weissel Sr., Hearst Newspapers Counsel in New York, to bring pressure on some advertisers, using Jenkins to bring pressure on others. I don't want to leave the impression that we muscled people to come as advertisers, but we did try to call it to their attention that we had the space available or the time available and could use the programming, Jenkins would say. And he was adding new stations. That summer he had a little time on his hands, of course, and we decided that we wanted to go and buy another station or perhaps two stations, Jenkins recalls. The station Johnson decided to buy was KANG in Waco, and he conducted the negotiations for that property with the old Johnson touch, bargaining with the owners for a favorable price while gently obtaining from compliant FCC Chairman Bartley advance knowledge of upcoming FCC decisions that would make KANG much more profitable for him than it would ever have been for them, and keeping that knowledge secret so that they would sell to him at a lower price. Lyndon made a lot of money that summer, Arthur Stelling says. And he was entering new fields as well, buying up stock in the Johnson City Bank and other little hill country banks. He took his naps, religiously, but woke up from them running, as fast as before. His pace, in fact, seemed to be even faster now. Asked years later, did the heart attack slow down Johnson? George Reedy replied, it speeded him up, if anything. Then, in September, the political landscape changed, dramatically. Dwight Eisenhower was at the very peak of his enormous popularity. In July, at a top-level conference in Geneva with British Prime Minister Anthony Eden, French Premier Edgar Faure, and the two Russian leaders, Nikita Khrushchev and Nikolai Buganin, Winston Churchill had coined a word for such a meeting, he called it a summit, Ike's broad open grin and his apparent candor and earnest desire for peace had won the hearts of Europeans, and his proposal for an open skies aerial inspection treaty to reduce the threat of nuclear war had captured the world's imagination. As he was flying home in triumph aboard the Columbine, Gallup pollsters were finding that no less than 4 out of 5 Americans approved of his performance as president. And then, on September 24th, he suffered a heart attack while on a golfing vacation in Denver. Ike's attack, a coronary thrombosis, was more serious than Johnson's, and Eisenhower, just 3 weeks short of his 65th birthday, was almost 18 years older. The Democratic National Convention was less than a year away, and the general assumption in Washington, an assumption that endured for months, was that the president would not run for another term. Lyndon Johnson, who during the next 3 days would telephone Eisenhower's press secretary, Jim Haggerty, 2 or 3 times a day to express concern and ask how the president was doing, thereafter he would be given daily reports by Jerry Persons, was almost instantly running for the prize he had always sought. The strategy he evolved, in talks with no one, lying deep in thought on the recliner or walking deep in thought along the path next to the Pernalis, was the strategy Richard Russell had used in 1952, but with a crucial difference. With Russell having removed himself from the picture, Johnson believed he would be the candidate of a solid South, with its 262 votes in the 1,200-vote convention. And he believed that because of the firm ties he had forged with Western and border state senators, he could do what Russell had not been able to do, collect enough votes from these states to give him a substantial block at the convention. At the moment, Stevenson had most of the Southern votes, as the least of three evils, the others being Kefauver and the New York liberal Harriman. If none of these three men could get a majority of the convention, it would be stalemated, and the nomination could well go to a fourth compromise candidate, if this candidate had a substantial solid block of votes behind him. The first requirement was that Southern support be stripped away from Stevenson. That would be accomplished by Johnson's entry into the race.
End of Disc 27.